Culture Affidavit, episode 164, Masters of the Universe. Hello and welcome to episode 164 of Pop Culture Affidavit, the podcast that takes a look at everything random in the world of popular culture, which is brought to you by the Two True Freaks Internet Radio Network. I'm your host, Tom Panarese. And for this episode, I'm going to travel back to the 80s and talk about a movie that has a reputation of being one of the more underwhelming live-action adaptations of a cartoon and toy line, as well as being one of a couple of big budget swings and misses that brought down 80s B-movie juggernaut canon films. It's 1987's Masters of the Universe. I'll be taking a look at the film, but also we'll talk about what I remember about collecting the Masters of the Universe toys, watching the He-Man and the Masters of the Universe cartoon, and ultimately why this movie does really give me a nice jolt of nostalgia, even if it's not the most well-regarded or well-remembered movies of the 80s. And I'll do that right after this trailer. Stick around.
A long time ago, in a comic book rack far, far away, during the years between The Empire Strikes Back and Return of the Jedi, Marvel Comics kept the Star Wars magic alive, delivering bold new stories, expanding the mythology, and taking our favorite heroes and villains on unforgettable adventures. Now join me, the irredeemable Shag, and an ever-changing roster of guest hosts as we journey back to this incredible era. We begin with a comic adaptation of The Empire Strikes Back and continue through the thrilling tales leading up to Return of the Jedi. If you're a seasoned Star Wars veteran who knows your Shira Bree from your hoojibs, or a brave explorer venturing into these comics for the first time, this is your hyperspace lane to classic Star Wars adventure. Join us for Marvel Star Wars, From Empire to Jedi, every other month on the Fire and Water Podcast Network, beginning in June 2025.
Now you can imagine all the power in the universe. The Masters of the Universe collection. 23 pieces, each sold separately. There's He-Man and these heroic action figures. Skeletor and the Warriors of Evil. And four fighting creatures. Castle Grayskull, Point Dread, and the Talon Fighter. You put them together. And battle machines like the Attack Track. Batteries not included. What would you do with all the power in the universe? Wow. He-Man, Skeletor, and all other items from the Masters of the Universe collection. Each sold separately. From Mattel.
So while I'm going to get to talking about the 1987 live-action film, I do want to start a few years earlier in the 80s, to around 1982, 1983. I was in the first grade that year, starting in the fall of 83. Masters of the Universe was one of two enormous things that were out there that what I was really into. The other, of course, was Star Wars, because 1983 saw the release of Return of the Jedi. Now, Mattel had put out the toy line the previous year. If you want, you can go watch a couple of really solid documentaries and specials about it on Netflix. Those specials get into how the people who created Masters of the Universe had a slightly different mythos surrounding the characters than what ended up in the Filmation cartoon. In fact, if you look at things like the box art from the toy line, along with some of the early comic books, the mini comics, etc., there are a little more... Well, adults are not the right word, but they're definitely not as cartoony and kiddie as you would see on the animated TV series. And I don't know if I ever did notice that in 1983 because I was six, right? And I wanted Castle Grayskull and I wanted the Burger King cups, so I probably didn't even register. I wrote about those Burger King cups a while back, and I'll link to it in the show notes, as well as a blog post that I wrote about the Prince Adam figure. And how I didn't get it, and how I was upset about that. So go to the show notes for any blog posts or something that I've mentioned Masters of the Universe stuff in the past. Anyway, toy line comes out in about 1982. 1983 is when the cartoon premieres. And for me, it was on Channel 5 in New York.
and the Masters of the Universe. I am Adam, Prince of Eternia and defender of the secrets of Castle Grayskull. This is Cringer, my fearless friend. Fabulous secret powers were revealed to me the day I held aloft my magic sword and said,
"By the power of Grayskull,
this is what many of us kids came to know." It introduced the idea that He-Man had the alter ego of Prince Adam, as well as characters like Orko. I want to say the Sorceress, but she might have been a part of the mythos prior to that. And the cartoon was extremely successful. There was an animated movie called He-Man and She-Ra, The Secret of the Sword, which helped spin off the She-Ra series. There was a Christmas special with, I believe, the two of them as well. And by the time She-Ra was around, there would be Channel 5 would be running like He-Man and then She-Ra back to back as sort of like an afternoon hour cartoon. And like everyone else, I saw the show right away and I got hooked. And it was one of the many cartoons I watched and one of the many toy lines that I collected through my childhood in the 80s. I had most of the figures and three of the big play sets. I had Castle Grayskull. I had Snake Mountain. My sister had the She-Ra castle, and I had the Horde headquarter thing where that came with the little lizard puppet that you stuck your hand in, and you could pretend that you were the alien, the chestburster from Aliens. Anyway, those were gifts from our Uncle Lou. My Uncle Lou had this reputation as the toy king. He always gave us these huge toy gifts. I might have mentioned it when I did some of my G.I. Joe toy coverage way, way back at the beginning of this podcast's history. So we played with the Masters of the Universe toys like crazy, too. What's funny, though, is that unlike Star Wars and G.I. Joe, where I often lost pieces and weapons, I managed to keep all of the weapons and pieces of the figures in the carrying cases. It's probably because they were bigger and they were harder to lose. I don't have anything from the Masters of the Universe stuff that I owned. I have a few Star Wars figures. I don't really have any of the G.I. Joe things I owned either. But when it came to Masters of the Universe, I actually do remember what happened to them. The kid across the street who my parents would watch from time to time really loved playing with them. And so we just gave everything to him. Because I was in like junior high or high school at that point. And hanging on to my old toys was not a priority. Plus, when I go back and think about the 80s, as much as I loved playing with my He-Man toys, they're a bit of a middle child between Star Wars and G.I. Joe. I had Transformers and I had Thundercats. They were to the side of those. Transformers and G.I. Joe were my two big ones. And because you couldn't integrate He-Man with the other two, because you could play G.I. Joe with Star Wars. They were the same size. But I couldn't do that with He-Man. He-Man was much bigger. Once I was done with He-Man, it never really came out again. Not in the way that I would have the Empire and Cobra together or the Rebels and G.I. Joe together. That being said, it's not like this wasn't popular. This isn't some niche thing that only I knew of or something like that. From 82 to about, you know, maybe 85, 86, Masters of the Universe toys and merchandise was all over the place. I had a ton of the toys, like I said. I had the Burger King cups, or at least most of them. I still have it. I had a picture disc record that I still have. It's a He-Man versus Skeletor story. I to this day, I don't remember which side is side A and which side is side B. It's not even labeled. I don't think I've listened to it in 40 years. I may throw it on my turntable one day just to hear what's on it. But yeah, anyway, it made sense that they made the movie because even before the movie was even announced, you had lunchboxes, folders, notebooks, birthday party supplies, garbage cans, Halloween costumes. I was a Skeletor one year for Halloween and I had the mask that you with the crappy rubber band went around it and it came with a sword. My mom made me a Skeletor costume with felt and a leotard. It's pretty cool. But that was probably about like 84. maybe. Maybe it was 83. It was 83, 84 when I was Skeletor for Halloween and when Masters Universe was at its height. By the time the film came out, it was already on the decline. They were selling. They were coming out with new lines. They had new play sets. I've never seen the Eternia one in person. I've just seen box art and catalog art, but it looked enormous. So they were making the effort. The show was still on. It was in perpetual reruns because it had run its course, but it was still on. And I think She-Ra was still on as well. But it didn't sell. Not on the level that you'd get with G.I. Joe at the moment. And in fact, if you think about it, 86 to 87, which is when we're talking about when the movie was in production and then came out, it's kind of the big transition year for toy lines in the 80s. You know, Star Wars was up over. It entered the Dark Age. I think there was the Power of the Force line in 85. You had droids and Ewoks. And around 86, there's nothing. Nothing new. Star Wars is over. Transformers, the movie comes out in 86. It is a landmark of our generation. But after the movie, you had the post-movie cartoon episodes, the post-movie year or so of toys, but then it just kind of fades as well. Yes, I know there was Generation 2. There was Beast Wars. The comic book went on for a while too, but it shrunk in popularity. The Thundercats, I think we're still kicking around at that point. I know I still had some of the toys that would start to fade. And Voltron had come and gone. Robotech had pretty much come and gone. And we'd get another year or so, and then you get the coming of the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, which was huge. Eventually you get things, as we get later in the decade, you get the real Ghostbusters. And then afternoon cartoon-wise, sometime toward the end of the decade, and I don't remember the precise year, I want to say 89 or maybe even 90, is when the Disney afternoon started. And then with DuckTales, Gummy Bears, Tailspin, Darkwing Duck, and so on and so forth. Live action movie versions of comic book and toy properties as well were not the norm in the 80s. So whereas today you have a Sonic the Hedgehog franchise, a Super Mario Brothers movie, a Legend of Zelda movie that they're making and such, there were very few superhero movies and TV shows that were live action when we were kids. There, most of them were animated. So what we would get instead of, say, Black Panther or Spider-Man or the X-Men or Batman, you know, or we get Batman at the end of the decade there, but, you know, Batman or whatever, we'd get animated stuff. So the Masters of the Universe toy line had been huge. The cartoon was huge. So we get the Secret of the Sword film, which was released in theaters, and then it could get chopped up into a multi-part TV storyline. The Hasbro could do that with a Transformers movie as well. They just kind of incorporated it into the regular run of the show. G.I. Joe had a movie that eventually got to release direct to video. I don't think it got a theatrical release, or if it did, it was very limited. That could get chopped up into multi-part episodes. And then there were a couple of other, just again, movie-length features that could also be packaged for syndication. The My Little Pony movie, there were two Care Bears movies, but they matched what you saw on TV. The Thundercats had a movie as well. Nothing had live action. Superman, Supergirl, that was pretty much it. There really wasn't anything else that I can think of that was a cartoon franchise that had a live action thing. So Mattel did try to blaze that trail with He-Man. The problem was that the toy line had peaked by the time things got off the ground, and it was really on its deathbed as the movie came out. I was kind of keeping an eye on things when I first heard about it. I remember seeing something in a really random place the first time I heard about this movie being made, which was called Masters of the Universe magazine. It was kind of like a fan club magazine, the same way you would have Star Wars and Star Trek, or like, I think you could get this on, you could get it like at the grocery store or stuff, because I'm pretty sure I got it at like Walbaum's. My dad and I were like, my dad was taking me for grocery shopping and I saw it in a magazine rack along with like Muppet magazine, for instance, and stuff like that. And in there you had, I think you had comic strips, you had sort of different toy related articles that were there for kids. And I remember an item or an article that was about how they were making a Masters of the Universe movie and Dolph Lundgren was going to be He-Man. And I'd seen Rocky IV a bunch of times at this point because I had a friend who loved that movie and would play, had it on VHS and would play it over and over and over and over again. And so I was pretty hyped for the movie. So I did see Masters of the Universe in the theater. I think I remember liking it. Actually, I think I remember it being really, really cool. And I know I rented it at least once, maybe twice. I do know that I own the copy that I rented from Sable's Video Empire. There's a story behind that I've told before, but I'll tell it again here. And it involves college. So, and my father. So my dad, as I've mentioned before, he's always been the action movie guy. I want to say this starts for him when he was a lot younger. There were movies like the Steve Reeves Hercules movies, for instance. Maybe even the old Johnny Weissmuller Tarzan movies. I know he loved James Bond back in the early days of the James Bond movies. Is when we went to see The Living Daylights, he's like, oh, you should go because like we loved the Connery ones and then we rented the Connery ones, et cetera, et cetera. So that led to him when we were kids taking us or renting with us or taking us to a lot of the, well, frankly, R-rated movies that were action movies. Arnold, Sly, Seagal, Van Damme. And this movie was PG. Masters of the Universe was PG. But he did take us to that. Me and a couple of my friends. And by the time I was in the late 80s, that genre of movie had really died out. And we would watch them every once in a while because I still had VHS copies of Commando and Predator, for instance. And if you remember the late 90s, which is when I was in college, we had the first big wave of 80s nostalgia. Like, you know, The Wedding Singer and Gross Went Blank and Romy Michelle had come out and, you know, more and more compilation CDs of 80s stuff. And I remember at one point we were having conversations about toys and stuff. And I mentioned this movie to my friends, my roommates. Some of them had seen it. Some of them hadn't. Some of them had, but they didn't remember it. And I didn't remember a ton about it. I remember Dolph Lundgren was in it. I remember that the bald guy from Top Gun and Back to the Future was in it. And my dad was like, what do you want for Christmas? This is 1988. And I said, can you track down a copy of this movie? But, you know, which was not easy. They were putting just about everything out on VHS at that point anyway. Like, cause you could go into Suncoast and for about somewhere anywhere between like $9.99 and $19.99, find almost anything that was made and put out. But Masters of the Universe was one of the few that you really couldn't. It was out of print. And it was never really that widely released on home video anyway. You know, they first put it out back in the mid-80s when a new copy of a movie on VHS was like about $80 or something, or $70 or $80. And that's why video stores had like one copy of something, unless they really had the money to buy two of Top Gun because they knew everybody would want Top Gun. So the story my dad tells about procuring this for me is that he went into Video Empire and asked the guy in the store, John, if he had an extra copy of the movie that he could sell. Because with a movie like that, they might have an extra that they don't need anymore. They'll sell it off to you for cheap. They would put them in pre-owned bins all the time. That's why I have had a bunch of John Hughes movies, because I bought them for $5 a piece. when they were trying to get rid of VHS and convert to DVD. Anyway, John's like, no, that's our only copy, but let me check the computer and see when it was last rented. He checks the computer. He says, oh, well, you know, it wasn't, hasn't been rented since 1992. Oh, and Wayne, you were the last one to rent it. So that's how I got my copy of Masters of the Universe on VHS. Now, I don't think we watched the movie all the way through. I brought it to college and we got through about maybe 30 minutes. My roommates were being pains in the ass, which is they were pains in the ass. So I'm not surprised, but they were being pains in the ass, even though they'd requested to watch it. And I remember one of my roommates was like obsessed with whether or not the Sorceress was going to be hot. By the way, the Sorceress was played by Christina Pickles, who was Ross and Monica's mom on Friends. And the only reason I know that we stopped watching it and turned it off about like 30, 35 minutes in is because when I put it into the VCR to watch it for this episode, it came up, I had to rewind 30 minutes of the tape. I had never actually rewound it 25 years ago. So there you go. Now, the movie itself was released in 1987. It was released on August 7, 1987. There's a bit of a backstory with regard to its production. I'm not going to go too deep into that, mainly because it's been talked about in articles, on blogs, on podcasts, and documentaries a few times over. Whatever I'm talking about would really me just be repeating what's been said, so I'll just kind of cover a little bit for context, though. The movie is written by David O'Dell. His credits include Supergirl, The Dark Crystal, and co-writing the Muppet Movie. It was directed by Gary Goddard. It's Goddard's only feature film. Most of his other credits are for theme park attractions and a couple of TV projects. And I should also note that he has sexual assault allegations against him from the same person who brought allegations against Bryan Singer. He's also had sexual assault allegations brought against him by the actor Anthony Edwards. As for our cast, as I mentioned, Dolph Lundgren played He-Man. He was hot off the success of his role as Ivan Drago in Rocky IV. And while he looked the part, his acting... Well, if I recall correctly, in the documentary Electric Boogaloo, The Story of Canon Films, Sylvester Stallone makes or made a wisecrack, something along the lines of, you're going to give this guy lines? Frank Langella plays Skeletor, and apparently he jumped at the chance to play Skeletor because his son was a huge fan of the He-Man toys. Film is also notable because it's a fairly early role for Courtney Cox. Prior to this, she had the video for Dancing in the Dark and the show The Misfits of Science. She'd go on Family Ties about a year or two after this movie. Now, the production had troubles. Mattel was overly controlling regarding how He-Man could be portrayed. For instance, they didn't want him to kill anybody, which is why like there's a bunch of robots instead of people that he shoots and kills. They didn't pay what they said they were going to pay. So that meant there were budget issues. In fact, I think at one point the producer or the director had to pay out of their own pocket to finish the movie. And this all almost prevented the movie from being finished at all. Later on, Lundgren said about articles that it was a terrible shoot. He wouldn't want to go through it again. Although apparently in recent years, he's warmed back up to the movie. And yes, the sales of the toys, like I said, had fallen off and that affected the movie's chances. When it opened in August of 87, it opened to a $4.8 million opening weekend, third behind The Living Daylights, which was the first Timothy Dalton James Bond movie, as well as Stakeout. Ultimately, the film would only gross just $17.3 million. It was number 65 for the year behind the Cheech Marin comedy Born in East L.A. and the Mickey Rourke, Lisa Bonet movie Angel Heart. I think that's the movie that got her kicked off the Cosby Show. Anyway, the top five movies for 1987, in case you're curious, were Beverly Hills Cop 2 at $153 million, followed by Platoon, Fatal Attraction, Stakeout, and Three Men and a Baby. Masters of the Universe was more or less universally panned, although Langella did get some praise for his performance as Skeletor. But I am not here to crap all over the movie. Instead, I want to talk about what I watched because I hadn't watched it since 1998, and even then, it wasn't in its entirety.
At the far end of the universe, there is a planet ruled by a being of utter evil. And there is only one man who dares challenge him. They are locked in a battle to the death. A battle that will take them across the heavens.
Stop him!
A battle that will finally be fought.
I want them hunted down and brought to me!
Across the face.
Police! Nobody move!
Of Earth.
I think I'm gonna need some backup.
Can you show us the way?
Of course.
No. Somebody help me!
From a distant galaxy, they have come to Earth. Dolph Lundgren as He-Man, Frank Langella as Skeletor. Only they have the powers to be. Masters of the Universe, live the adventure.
We open in Castle Grayskull, which Skeletor has taken over, imprisoning the sorceress and siphoning her power so that at some point when the moon is in the seventh house and Jupiter aligns with Mars, he can open a universal gateway of some sorts and all the powers of the universe will come to him. And it is, as he says, about 650 times in the movie, his destiny. Meanwhile, what's left of the resistance against Skeletor is trying to make some sort of move. He-Man, Man-at-Arms, and Teela come across a creature named Gwildor, who is played by Billy Barty. He was a little person actor who you probably best remember as the wizard, the Heinelwyn wizard in Willow. Gwildor has developed a transportation device called the Cosmic Key. It's a cylinder with keys all over it and a tuning fork-looking things. Press the right combo and you open a gateway to other worlds. There are only two cosmic keys in existence. Skeletor has one, and he acquired it by having Evil Lyn, who is played by Meg Foster. She's in They Live with Roddy Piper. Evil Lyn tricked him into handing it over, and that's what has allowed Skeletor's forces to ambush the forces of good and take over Grayskull. Gwildor has the original prototype of the key, and it's the only one in existence. This, therefore, is your movie's MacGuffin. So He-Man and company are attacked again. Eventually, they're able to get to Grayskull, where there's a brief standoff with Skeletor. But seeing that they're about to lose, Gwildor opens a gate at random using the key, and everybody jumps through it. They emerge on Earth. They're scattered about in a town in California. Eventually, they meet up and go searching for the key, but not after encountering a cow. Anyway, the two people who come across the key are Earth human residents Kevin, who is played by Robert Duncan McNeil, who would go on to play Tom Paris on Star Trek Voyager, and Julie, who is, of course, played by Courtney Cox. Their boyfriend and girlfriend, they're paying a last visit to Julie's recently deceased parents at a cemetery before Julie moves across the country to New Jersey, much to Kevin's dismay. Kevin, who is a keyboardist in a band, thinks that this cosmic key is a cool new Japanese synthesizer. He starts playing around with it, and while doing a sound check for the band's performance at the school dance, what happens, though, is that it sends out a signal that Skeletor is able to track with the other key. He locks in on it, and Skeletor is going to send some mercenaries after the key. Kevin decides to head off to his friend Charlie's music store to show him the key, while Skeletor sends mercenaries after it. We have Blade, we have Beastman, we have Sora, and we have Karg. They attack Julie at the school. They set the school on fire. In the process of giving chase, He-Man and the heroes show up, and Skeletor's mercenaries return to Eternia. Furious at their failure, Skeletor kills Sorod and sends Evil Lyn, along with more troops and the rest of the mercenaries, after the key and after He-Man. Things get complicated because Detective Lubick, and that is James Tolkien from Top Gun and Back to the Future, confiscates it after the fire at the school and while he's questioning Kevin. Evil Lynn and her forces attack Kevin at Julie's house and interrogate him by using some sort of truth-telling collar, getting him to reveal where the key is. This eventually leads to a fight at Charlie's music store, which is blown more or less to bits while He-Man fights Evil Lynn's forces. Kevin, Julie, Lubick, and Gwildor hide in the back of the store while Gwildor tries to access the gateway to Eternia using the key that they have. While he's doing that, Julie sees her dead mom in the alley behind the store. She runs to her dead mom, and dead mom says that she's actually not dead. They're just doing important work for the government, and they need the key to complete it. Julie, thinking that dead mom is real mom, gives it to dead mom and discovers that dead mom is Evil Lynn. Evil Lynn summons Skeletor to Earth. Skeletor's forces eventually overcome the Eternians. He-Man is captured and taken back to Eternia with the promise that his friends won't be harmed. Julie is blasted with Skeletor's evil finger lightning, and the wound instantly gets infected. Poison starts to race through her body. The forces of evil don't get to take the key back, though, because our heroes manage to snag it before they go through the portal. Unfortunately, in the process of the battle, the key got fried, so the memory was erased, and there are so many combinations of keys that it's going to take Gwildor forever to figure out what it is. Kevin, though, is a keyboard player, and Kevin can memorize things really quickly if he hears them. And Kevin heard the melody the key played, and Kevin remembers the melody. So what Gwildor says is, give me a bunch of parts and devices, you know, like a speak and spell and several things that Teela has on her armor and a Casio. And what they do, they all attach them to the key, and Kevin starts playing the melody on the Casio, and the key activates, and that's when Lubick shows up. And he's going to arrest everybody. But we head back to Eternia really quickly. And at Eternia, Skeletor has He-Man in chains, tortures him, and then opens the Cosmic Universe Eye Portal thing and gains all the power in the universe, changing from his black cloak to golden samurai armor. And he has eye blasts now and finger blasts. And he declares himself a god, as you do. And just when things seem lost, all of our heroes return, including Lubick, right into Castle Grayskull, and a fight starts. Lubick joins in, blasting Skeletor's shock troops with his shotgun, and He-Man eventually gets out of the chains. He goes after Skeletor. He grabs his sword, which Skeletor held captive, yelling, "I have the power!" And the two of them fight. He-Man destroys Skeletor's staff of power, bringing him back to normal, and when the villain tries to take him out, He-Man sends Skeletor flying over him and into one of the pits in Castle Grayskull. Everything goes back to normal. Peace is restored. The sorceress thanks everyone and gives Julie a trinket so she'll always have Eternia with her. And Gwildor sends them all back to Earth. Just as they're headed back, though, Julie tries to request that Gwildor send them back to before her parents died, but it looks like she did it too late. Or did she? Julie wakes up in her bedroom, heads downstairs, and sees her father reading the morning news. She sees her mother as well, and then she begs them not to take their ill-fated flight to Catalina Island. She says, "I have a bad feeling about this." And they're insistent that they're going to go, so she swipes the keys and runs out of the house. And as she runs out of the house, she runs into Kevin. And Kevin and her both realize that it was all real. And they realize what Gwildor did, and Julie holds out the Eternia trinket, and inside of which we see He-Man saying, "I have the power!" There's also a post-credits sequence of Skeletor popping his head up from a pink slimy liquid and saying that he'll be back. Of course, he never was. The movie flopped. Sequel was proposed, but the failure of this, as well as Superman IV, The Quest for Peace, led to canon abandoning that, as well as an Albert Pune-directed Spider-Man movie. What was left of those productions was used for sets and props for the Jean-Claude Van Damme movie Cyborg, which I covered a couple of years ago. In fact, for a while, unlike TV listings, Cyborg was called Masters of the Universe 2, even though it had no connection. If I'm going to give my review of the movie here, I think if you want to sum it up in one sentence, it is the very definition of an epic on a budget. You could tell that Gary Goddard, who's the director, had a vision for the film, but he only had so much to work with, so much money to make it to come to life. In fact, and you can read about this more in depth on the film's Wikipedia page, there's a lot of references to Jack Kirby's work, especially the Fourth World saga. And I can totally see the influence, especially in Skeletor as a dark side character, the cosmic key being kind of a mother box that's creating boom tubes. I really like the Eternia sets. I really like the way they created Castle Grayskull. It looks really cool. I liked the costumes. You know, they didn't go with the same color scheme for He-Man. Instead, they went with a black version of his costume along with a cape. Not so much with the cape, but I did like the costume. Lundgren looks the part. Lundgren also proves that even in the land of fantasy, you can always find hair product and get a blowout. Man-at-Arms costume is actually accurate to the figure, even if they just went with an all-gray color scheme. Teela does not look like she does in the cartoon, but I really like Teela's costume. It's pretty much like her father's costume, but in a female form, and she's holding a blaster instead of sword or staff, so it's the sci-fi side of things. But if they're like resistance fighters and soldiers, it's way more practical than kind of like a Wonder Woman-esque type of costume. The villains look awesome too. Skeletor, you know, I know we're used to the blue, purple, and Skeletor with the yellow skull. Here, it's just black costume, white skull. It's a really cool looking costume. And we still have that staff that's like the head of Baphomet or whatever it is or something. It's purple on the action figure. And it really, I mean, they really did a good job of altering it for the film just enough to make it look cool on camera, but still identifiable as Skeletor. And the same thing with He-Man. And Eva Lynn's costume actually is pretty accurate too. And they use the fact that Meg Foster has very distinctive eyes to their advantage. So she didn't have to wear like contact lenses or anything to look strange or evil or unsettling. And while Beast Man doesn't have any lines, that also looks pretty accurate. It's a cool costume as well. I even like the new characters. To this day, I like Blade. This is cool sword fighting moments. I could take or leave Gwildor. He's clearly a stand-in for a character like Orko. I think I read somewhere they couldn't get the effect they would need for Orko to work, so they just created him. Eternia's a well-done sequence, even if the purse strings are showing. But I will say it's when we get to Earth that the movie just kind of falls apart for me. The idea of putting kids or other human characters into a fantasy movie as sort of a viewer stand-in, it was a trope all over 80s films. Think of E.T., The Last Starfighter, The Neverending Story, Tron. You know, the cosmic key being the MacGuffin, why do they come to Earth? Okay, but why pick teenagers? Like, E.T. has kids. The Neverending Story has a kid. There's a later movie that I talked about in the Fallen Walls Open Curtains miniseries called Ruskies that was kids. Julie is like, they've graduated high school. They're going to graduate high school. She's working at a ribs joint and it takes place over a couple of hours. But I don't know, like the teenage part doesn't work for me. And it's what's funny is that I talked about budget strings and everything like that. The movie takes place like in the middle of the night. And there's like no other extras. There's extras in the restaurant where they have the scene in the restaurant where Julie, like, you know, right before they find the key and everything. But anytime we're in the town that they live, there's just like every street's like deserted and stuff. And maybe they just couldn't afford the extras for it. At least with the Earth scenes, they stick to a tight time frame. So the fish out of water comic relief stuff does not involve days upon days upon days of them trying to figure out like how to present He-Man and his friends to like the rest of the world, like it's Encino Man or something. There's a couple of funny little comic relief scenes that I've seen with the cow. Gwildor swipes a bucket of ribs from a convertible and they're eating it. And at one point, Man-at-Arms knows they're eating an animal, but Teela doesn't. She's like disgusted. It's kind of cute. Gwildor rolls up dressed in some of like Dorothy's Bornax hand-me-downs. He refits a classic car to make it go insanely fast. It kind of works. It gets a little tedious in places. So does the sci-fi stuff. except with He-Man. So I mentioned a little earlier that Mattel didn't want to show He-Man killing people or the heroes killing people. So they created robot shock troops for Skeletor. And so when He-Man can kill the robot shock troops, he's just killing robots, right? Well, it's the 80s, right? And even though He-Man's a fantasy, sword and sorcery fantasy property, we need lasers. So Man-at-Arms and Teela have blasters. Okay, I can see that. The way they're set up in the movie makes total sense. But and He-Man's carrying his sword like he's supposed to. But he also ends up with a gun half the time, and he uses the gun way more than he does the sword. Speaking of swords, the sword fights, they're good and bad. The swords, they're fighting with heavy swords. This isn't lightsabers where they're like wiffle ball bats, right? They're like broadsword types, and they look heavy. And Lundgren swinging them, blades swinging them, they look like they're heavy. So I like that they did make it look a little more realistic, but it's kind of clunky. And while Blade's swordplay is pretty cool to watch, the fight at the end between He-Man and Skeletor just doesn't match up to the sword fights we would see in other movies of the era. Canon didn't have Star Wars money, but they could have taken some cues from Highlander and played with camera angles. Instead, it really, it's on budget, this final fight between He-Man and Skeletor. It's weirdly lit. There are cuts and close-ups because it's clearly you can't show too much or else we're going to see that we had no money to do this. And it doesn't really last very long. And I know it has to do with the behind-the-scenes troubles because apparently Goddard had to put up his own money to film that fight. And from what I read, the only people on the set were him, Lundgren, Langella, and maybe a small crew to run the cameras and stuff. So you're going to get something underwhelming when you have something like that. But at the same time, I did have fun watching the movie. The heroes look like action figures. For all the clunkiness it has, it's fun to watch, especially on VHS. I mean, I know you can stream it here and there. I think it's on YouTube. You rent it via Apple TV Plus. I think it's on Pluto TV if you look hard enough. But I don't know, man. I would have had to pay for it. I would have had to watch commercials. But I've got the VHS. I'm going down a nostalgia rabbit hole. Let me pop the tape into my VCR. And that was, I think, one of the big appeals of doing this episode and watching this movie. It's where the nostalgia comes in. I said earlier in the episode that I did love these toys and I loved the cartoon when I was a kid, but I called it kind of a middle child, right? Because compared to, say, Star Wars or G.I. Joe, Masters of the Universe doesn't have the same level of fondness for me. I used to go on the site He-Man.org when it was still operating. It was fun to click around and check out what was there, just kind of the same way I would look at Yojo.com and do that as well. But for the most part, I don't really revisit Masters of the Universe all that much. I haven't really watched anything that they've come out in recent years. I did watch the She-Ra cartoon that Netflix put out a few years ago because Brett was watching it. But other than that, nothing else really. But that act of watching that videotape that had a movie from your childhood on it, I mean, I could do that all day because I did it so much when I was a kid. And even though it's fleeting, that's a feeling that you can recapture from time to time. You might think it's an odd reason to love a movie like this one, but isn't that why we go back and watch them in the first place? Right? They could be terrible movies, but we have a fondness for them. And that's what makes them fun. Before I go, I have a couple pieces of feedback. They're actually both old emails that I just noticed were in my inbox. And I apologize to both of them because I checked the Pop Culture Affidavit email. But what happens is I get a lot of like spam emails of like, you know, so-and-so saying they can monetize my blog, you know, that sort of stuff and what have you. So these definitely got buried among all of those. And this first one is from late October of 2024. It's from David Uranga or Uranga. The subject is a nerd like me. He says, I've been lurking on your blog post on your blog, been lurking on your blog for years. I felt like I was the only one in junior high who watched Degrassi Junior High. Like you, I did not have cable TV in the Dallas, Texas area. My parents refused to pay for it. They could afford it, just not like, they just did not like the content on it. They did not want us watching TV all day. Yep. Trauma recognizes trauma. So I was the only person in junior high and high school who did not have cable. Oh my God. I'm with you here, David. So I'd ask some kids what show they were watching. They would tell me some random show I'd never heard of. I asked what channel was on. They'd say cable TV. I'll have to talk to you guys later. You know, thanks mom and dad for making me not have any friends. The only friend I had in junior high was this kid named Nick I met in Boy Scouts, and I would watch cable TV at his house. I swear that's like half the reason I went to my friend's houses was to watch MTV, dude. So I totally get you. And my friend Rich had an illegal cable box, which meant that he had the Playboy channel, but that's another story for another day. So he said, David says, that I preferred Saved by the Bell to Degrassi. It was silly and wacky. Degrassi was way too serious. I got drunk in college and no one died. I just got physically sick a couple of times and went to bed. Your episode recaps of Degrassi, which was I was doing on the blog for a while, are great on the blog and takes me back to my youth. I was lucky in Texas. Only two people bullied me in junior high. Then I moved to California and even the girls started bullying me for no reason. I don't miss those days. Then in high school, I just studied for school. That was it. In college, I lived pretty much in the library. Glad YouTube had not been invented yet. I would have failed out. Me too. Knew this guy in college who was on academic probation due to playing too many video games. Yeah, I knew a few people like that as well, man. And I was the kid in the 80s. The house could have been burning down and I would have died with the NES ROFL. Yeah. I was so low on the social ladder in junior high, I could not even see it. My sister and brother were popular in junior high and high school must have been nice. Cheers, David. You know, as tortured as that is, in a sense, I relate to it. I did have my group of friends. I don't want to relitigate junior high and high school, but yeah, you think back to the things that you watched and held dear, and then the weird social dynamics that existed around things like cable, and then what you would get bullied for, and what rabbit holes you could fall down to that would distract you from what you actually needed to do. And I can completely relate to David's email. So thank you very much. Joe Page is our second email. He sent me an email about an old blog post from 2014. It's when I wrote about the OJ Simpson Bronco chase. And the subject of the email is STP. He says, I'm watching the Netflix show 30 for 30, June 17, 1994, and anything to do with the O.J. Simpson chase always reminds me of STP being on The Late Show with David Letterman, but it never airing. I remember going to my dad's house for the weekend, my parents were divorced, and staying up late to watch Letterman, but it never aired because of the chase. I searched STP on Letterman, and your blog popped up in the search results, and I wanted to let you know how I found it. I'm glad to know I'm not the only one who knows they missed out on SCP airing on Letterman that night. Thanks for reading, Joe. Yeah, I don't know why that's such a prominent detail in my head. I just, because I was like really into Stone Temple Pilots. Purple had just came out, I believe. So maybe that was a big reason I wanted to see it. I want to say it was rerun later that summer or sometime the following year when The Late Show was in reruns. During the off season. I might have watched it, but I don't remember off the top of my head. But again, Joe, thank you, David. Thank you for emailing. I apologize for taking so long to get your emails. I hope you liked other posts and episodes on the blog, on the podcast. If any of you who are listening here would like to email and comment on my show notes here or this episode or any of the blog posts or anything like that, go right ahead. I'll read them in the next episode. And as for me, that's it. I'll be back in a month with something else. Actually, it's the beginning of June, so my plan, fingers crossed, is to get an episode out at the end of June, right around the 23rd, which is my birthday. And the plan is to be about music, specifically some of the music of Billy Joel. So that's what I'm thinking of doing in about maybe 3-4 weeks or so. So come back for that. And until then, thank you very much for listening. Take care. And as they say in the film and on Eternia, good journey. Thanks for listening to Pop Culture Affidavit, which is hosted and produced by me, Tom Panarese. The theme music is Pop Rock by Scott Holmes and is used under Creative Commons licensing. You can contact and follow me via email at popcultureaffidavit@gmail.com, on Facebook and Instagram as Pop Culture Affidavit, and on Blue Sky as Pop Aff. That's P-O-P-A-F-F. And of course, you can find episode links, show notes, and blog posts on my website, popcultureaffidavit.com. Thanks very much for listening, and come back next time for more pop culture randomness.